representing. Of IPv6 deployment to all stakeholders in the internet. We're at a point in history now where we're seeing certainly some developments happening quite quickly in terms of the deployment of IPv6, and so we'll hear a few different perspectives on that. Just a quick run through the agenda, which I don't have on the slide, but we'll start out with an update from Andrea Chima and myself. I'll introduce myself. I'm Chris Buckridge. I'm the External Relations Officer for the RIPE NCC. So Andrea and I will provide a quick update on IPv6 in this service region, the RIPE NCC service region, and also from some of the other RIR perspectives. We'll then have presentations from Frederick Donk and Matt Ford from the Internet Society about the World IPv6 launch, which took place last month and has had some significant effect around the world. We then have the public sector government perspective, and we have a couple of representatives from Sweden here today, Maria Hell and Anders Rafting, to speak about that. Then André Philippe from CZNIC will present on ccTLDs and IPv6 deployment. And we'll conclude with Jeff Houston from APNIC speaking about the evolving internet and IPv6. So I hope we also have the chance to hear from people in the audience. Certainly if you have any questions between speakers or at the end of the session, please feel free to get up and ask them of any of the panelists. Okay, so we might start with Andrea Chima.
Good morning, everyone. As Chris mentioned, my name is Andrea Chima. I'm the Registration Services Manager at the RIPE NCC. And I will start the session with just a few slides about IPv6 policy and allocation statistics in the RIPE NCC service region. Now, the RIPE NCC allocates IPv6 address space. The allocation process is based on policy. This policy is made by the RIPE community. Now, according to the current policy, in order to qualify for an IPv6 allocation, an organization must be an LIR, meaning a member of the RIPE NCC, and must have a plan of making assignments, IPv6 assignments, to customers within the coming 2 years. At the moment, the allocation size, the minimum allocation size issued by the RIPE NCC is /32. However, the allocation can be larger than that, and the size of the allocation is based on the size of the network of the operator requesting the address space and its customer base. Now, as I've just mentioned, the minimum allocation size is /32 at the moment. This will change very soon because the RIPE community has recently accepted a policy proposal, Policy 2011-04, according to which LIRs can receive a larger initial IPv6 allocation block, meaning a /29. This also means that operators which have received an IPv6 allocation, a /32 in the past, can request an extension to the larger block of a /29. We are currently working on the implementation, and the policy should be implemented in July this year. Now, how many IPv6 allocations has the RIPE NCC made over time? If we look at the past 3 years, we can see that there is a slight but constant growth in the number of allocations issued on a monthly basis. And specifically with a spike, that's quite interesting to see from the graph. Around the end of 2010 and the beginning of 2011, with a peak in February 2011. And this moment was during the moment that IANA exhausted its IPv4 allocation pool, and this created more awareness of the need of IPv6 between our members. Now, if we look at the IPv6 allocations issued in the Czech Republic, also on a monthly basis for the last 3 years, we can see that the trend is more or less the same as the rest of the region. And also here, very interesting to see, we had the same exact spike in February 2011. Now, issuing allocations is just one phase of the deployment of IPv6, of course. It's not everything. So the RIPE NCC, in order to monitor the deployment of IPv6, has created a rating system, which we call IPv6 ripeness. This rating system gives 1 star to every member which has an IPv6 allocation, It gives an additional star if the organization has created a route object in the route database, an additional star if the reverse DNS is set up, and finally the last star when the IPv6 prefix is actually visible on the routing tables. Now, on our website, routeness.route.net, we have a list of all the four-star LIRs, but also statistics per country, so that we are able to see what the level of IPv6 deployment is according to the ripeness rating system in our service region. Now, if we look at the numbers, the RAPNCC has slightly over 8,000 members. We can see that about 50% of them have zero stars, meaning that 50% has not yet requested an IPv6 allocation. About 1,200 have one star, meaning they have requested an allocation. About 500 of them have created a route object in the route database. About 1,000 of them have set up reverse DNS. And we have 1,500 members with a four-star rating, meaning that they are actually announcing their IPv6 address space. If we look at the ripeness level in the Czech Republic, it's interesting to see that the number of members with zero stars is actually lower. So we have, compared to the average in the RIPE region, we have a higher deployment of IPv6. And also, if you look, quite interesting to see at the number with four stars, it's about 25% of our members in this country. So, yeah, like I previously mentioned, it's the deployment of IPv6 has a higher level in this country.
I'll continue the presentation. As Andrea mentioned, obviously allocation of IPv6 is one aspect, and then we also monitor deployment. One of the other important things or important areas that the RIPNCC and the other RIRs work in is outreach and capacity building. And I want to start with a slide here talking about the International Telecommunications Union. This is not in the context that you've probably heard them discussed in the last few days and over the last few months. In 2009, the ITU Council actually established an IPv6 group, and this was to look at a number of issues, including the ITU's role in IPv6 allocation and distribution. This group actually met several times over the past few years and actually held its final meeting last month. And it was interesting that one of the only real resolutions that came out of that was an acknowledgement of the importance that capacity building plays in IPv6. There's a quote here from a contribution that the United Arab Emirates made to that that final session, which says, "Capacity building programs are believed to pave the way for any future successful IPv6 strategies or action plans, and we would like to invite the stakeholders to consider this as a model for smooth transition and better outreach." So in internet governance, there's a lot of talk about multi-stakeholderism, so I think this is an example of that at work. And the background to that UAE contribution is work that the RIPNCC has done quite closely with the public sector in UAE. And this brings us to one of the main capacity building activities that we've been involved in, and this is the IPv6 Roadshow. Now, this is an activity that we work with MENOG, the Middle East Network Operators Group, on, and they're hands-on trainings running 3 to 5 days, which are specifically targeted at network operators in the public sector. And so this is a reflection of how the industry is structured in the Middle East, so trying to engage with the industry there in a way that will be useful and helpful to them. We launched in 2010, and we've currently had about 12 events. We've got 3 more booked and a great deal of interest from countries all around the region. We provide it free of charge with the host government or telco providing the venue and getting the attendees. And we are interested in looking at taking this beyond just the Middle East. As I said, it's targeted really specifically at the way the industry is shaped in some of the emerging markets. And so we're looking at maybe the Russian CIS region as an opportunity. We're working quite closely with APNIC as well, so that can work in the sort of Indian region or around there. And we're also looking to partner with AFRINIC, to see what we can do in terms of the African region. And the next step also is a train-the-trainer program. So this is something that we're looking at, which will sort of extend the reach of that program by actually relying and using the talent and the people who are on the ground in those regions to spread the education using the material that we've developed. So beyond that, we're also obviously working closely with regional and national groups. I mentioned the Middle East Network Operators Group. We also have been really quite instrumental in getting the Eurasian Network Operators Group established. That's in the Russian CIS region. And we facilitate various community initiatives in RIPE. So this first one that I have, IPv6 requirements in ICT, this is a document that came out of our community and again is targeted at the public sector, and particularly public sector or large enterprise who are doing requests for proposals for new infrastructure. And this document actually lays out the specifications that they can include in those RFPs to ensure that they have IPv6 compatibility in their networks. We've had really an incredible response from this, and various governments translating the document and for use in their own country. And it's actually just been revised by the team of people in the RIPE community who've been working on it. Additionally, there's the CPE survey. This is something that we've tried to crowdsource to get input on what customer premises equipment is actually IPv6 compatible, comparing some of the manufacturer claims against real-world experience. And finally, we provide a range of statistics and analysis. Andrea already showed you the IPv6 ripeness. There's a range of other tools and statistics that we showcase on our RIPE Labs website, which is labs.ripe.net. And finally, multi-stakeholder outreach. So this is the more broad kind of outreach that we do to the public sector and to international organizations. I mentioned the ITU, IPv6 group, is something we take part in. The OECD is another forum where we contribute. All of the RIRs contribute there. The Internet Governance Forum, the RIRs working as the NRO, have done IPv6 workshops at, I think, the last 4 or 5 IGF events. Beyond that, we also obviously consult with individual governments. We've taken part in a number of government task forces in certainly countries including Qatar, Lebanon, Moldova. And we provide a range of online resources. So I've listed IPv6 Act Now here. That's our sort of general information site and the RIPE Labs website. But this next page, this is actually all of the RIR IPv6 resources that are online. So this, hopefully, you, depending on your region, this will be able to give you a more specific assistance in terms of getting more information and learning more about what you can do, what events are happening, accessing educational material. And so that brings me to the end. Are there any questions for either Andrea or myself? In that case, we might move on. So the next presentation is from ISOC, I think starting with Frederick Dong.
No slides. Will I keep it? Hi, my name is Frederick Dong. I'm leading our effort, the Internet Society effort, in the European region from our Brussels-based office. In a few seconds, and we'll also give the floor to Matt Ford, who is just still in the UK. Matt is a technology program manager. He's part of the team, the core team, who has coordinated our effort for the World IPv6 launch. So I would like to start with some general information on the impact of this launch. You will see that it's quite impressive, actually. We should really be proud of all the efforts that we and the internet community as a whole, ours, have done for this launch. I will walk you through some figures, starting with this one. More than 3,000 website operators contribute to the World IPv6 launch on 6 June, including 5 of the top 6 in the global ranking of Alexia, so Google, Facebook, YouTube, Yahoo, and Wikipedia. 65. This is the number of networks operators who participate, among them AT&T, Comcast, Free, Time Warner, Verizon. And then 5 home routers vendors among Cisco, D-Link, NEC, Yamaha, and Zilex. So truly, lots of participation, great results. And I will give you some media and media coverage. The objective from our perspective was to make sure that the message IPv6 is the new normal got through press and media, and really it got perfectly well. We have more than 300 articles on the 19th of June, so there's still more coming. Among them, Agence France-Presse, BBC, Brisbane Times, Circle ID, CNN, Le Figaro, Forbes, Heise.de, New York Times, Times Magazine, etc. We also were very active on the social media side. We had, for example, a 24-hour video rollout via the world IPv6 launch on YouTube. We had about 35 videos that contribute to those efforts. Twitter, we had about 3,000 followers on the 6th of June. Facebook, about 1,000 likes. We also had Google+. YouTube, we had about 7,657 video views. And the most watched on the playlist were someone called Windsurf with more than 500,000 views on the day. Webmetrix, over 1 million page views from more than 500,000 unique visitors at our address, www.ipvxange.org. So truly impressive, as I said. Top locations of visitors, of course, the U.S., came first, followed by Germany, UK, Japan, China, and we also have Finland among the top 10. Last but not least, as I said, the whole technical community contribute to the effort, RRs, as we know, but also the Internet Society chapters. We had more than 30 Internet Society chapters who enable their website, held live events or engage in other outreach at national and local level. Among them, Argentina, Brazil, Cameroon, England, India, Chennai, Mexico, the Netherlands, of course, US, Venezuela. So again, also at local level, it was truly a great success. One more note. I personally engaged with press and media in Europe, and what was really exciting is that press just got the message and understood very well that this launch was just not something bigger, larger, different than the World IPv6 Day last year. They just really understood that the Internet would change forever, and as you could see from some of the headlines, we really went through. I give you some of those. IPv6 is the new normal for the Internet, and this one, World IPv6 launch, only the biggest change to the Internet since its inception. So really, with this, I would like to give the floor to Matt, who will present you the measurement and result of this day. Matt, up to you.
Thanks very much, Frederick. I hope you can all hear me.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sorry you have to put up with a disembodied voice for this presentation, but I couldn't be in Prague this week, unfortunately. But I'm happy to present to you some of the detailed results from World IPv6 launch. As Frederick has described, you know, we certainly made a big splash in the media, but, you know, at the end of the day, the real objective was to try and get IPv6 deployment more pervasive. And so I'll walk you through a bit of what we've seen by way of results from the event in that respect. So if I could have the next slide, please. So just a sort of quick recap, World IPv6 launch was on the 6th of June this year. It's a little different to what we did last year with World IPv6 Day, which was very much a 24-hour event where we were focusing on content providers and asking them to turn up IPv6 for a 24-hour period. World IPv6 launch is really, you know, something that began on the 6th of June and will continue. And so it's a really a different type of event and much broader reach. So focusing on trying to get IPv6 as part of regular business and on by default with no special configuration necessary in access networks, home router vendors or, you know, customer premises equipment and websites all over the world. And so there's those three categories of participants all agreeing to these sort of headline objectives of on by default. And the purposes for this were really to accelerate deployment and adoption amongst those that have plans or don't have plans yet, to really stimulate the industry and indicate that, you know, major players are now turning this on and leaving it on. There's nothing to stop you if you and your business have been watching this for some time and haven't made the move yet. It's the time is now, and really to establish, as Frederick has described, that IPv6 is the new normal for the internet. So those were the kind of headline objectives. And I'll just take you through a bit of each of those three categories of access networks, home router vendors, and content providers, and walk you through a bit about, you know, what we were asking each of those groups to do and what results we saw. So if I could have the next slide. So for access networks... can we go back, please, to the previous slide? Thanks. There we go. So our inaugural participants were AT&T and Comcast and Time Warner Cable in the US, Free in France, Internode in Australia, KDDI in Japan, and Access for All in the Netherlands. But we had 69 networks achieve a measurable deployment with an average of at least 0.1% on the 6th of June this year. I should explain a bit about what that means. So networks had to have networks were being measured by the content providers, so Google, Facebook, and Yahoo, and those major content providers had to see a specific amount of traffic from a network in order, in order to be able to reasonably accurately measure the percentage of IPv6 they were seeing from that network. So unfortunately, that did mean that some networks that registered weren't able to measure them, and consequently they weren't included in these numbers. But we did have 69 measurable deployments showing at least 0.1% of their traffic over IPv6. And so, you know, the ask for the access networks was to give new subscribers IPv6 by default without any special user configuration. And the goal was for them to reach 1% of their visits to those major content providers over IPv6 by the 6th of June. And as I mentioned, that was measured by Google, Facebook, and Yahoo. The results are online at that link there. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, 1% sounds like a small number, but in order for access networks to deliver 1% of their traffic over IPv6 to these content providers, in most cases that means that they need to enable IPv6 access for a much higher percentage of their subscriber base because of the levels of support in the CPE that those subscribers are using, the operating systems that those subscribers are using, and indeed applications in the websites that they visit. So to get to 1%, the access networks had to do a lot more work than that might suggest. So if I can have the next slide, please, I'll take you through a bit of the detailed results from the access network piece of World IPv6 launch. So I don't know how legible that is where you are. I'm looking at it on the stream here, and it's not legible to me. But I'll switch to my other copy. But the point here is that on the left here, these are the results recorded on the 11th of June for the participating network operators. And you'll see that in this list there are a lot of academic networks, which, you know, academic networks and the national research networks have been at the forefront of IPv6 deployment for many years. But what's really interesting about this is that we're starting to see major mass market broadband ISPs come through with really very significant IPv6 deployments, delivering really quite substantial amounts of IPv6 traffic. So top of the list is Free in France, then AT&T in the US, KDDI in Japan, RCS and RDS in Romania, Comcast, Verizon, and then we get into some of the academic deployments, ChessNet and eighth on this list. And you know, you'll see that there's really, if you look at the percentage figures for IPv6 traffic, these are by no means trivial or trial IPv6 deployments. This is major IPv6 deployment to end users, all over the globe. I mean, you'll see on the right there, there's a heat map which is just counting the number of ISPs that we had participate and achieve our threshold, and the majority in the US, but ISPs also participating and passing the threshold from all over the world. So I think this has really been a great success of World V6 launch, was to move the access providers to make really substantial IPv6 deployments, and these are the results that we've seen. I should also mention that we plan to continue making these measurements through the end of this year. So we'll have monthly updates to these numbers. And if you go to worldipv6launch.org/measurements, you'll be able to see the updated numbers as this progresses. I think if you take away anything from this presentation, it's this slide and these numbers and the fact that major broadband mass market ISPs are deploying IPv6 all over the world. And unsurprisingly, if you deploy IPv6, you generate large amounts of IPv6 traffic. So next slide, please. So for the home router vendors, which is another big challenge for IPv6 deployment, we had initially Cisco and D-Link participate, and they were joined by three other home router vendors by the 6th of June. And again, the ask was again that IPv6 becomes part of their regular business. So by that we meant that the majority of their products would ship with V6 on by default. So there's no special user configuration required. You know, if you buy these products, they've been interoperability tested by the University of New Hampshire, and V6 is on by default. So particularly if you're using any of these products with any of those access ISPs, you should just have IPv6 connectivity without having to do anything. This is an area where there's still, you know, really considerable work remains to be done. Both for, you know, other CPE vendors, really, to make this a pervasive feature of CPE on the market today, but also other kinds of consumer devices, televisions, voice over IP handsets, and so on. There's a lot more work there that needs to be done for IPv6 deployment. And the next slide, please. So on the content providers, as I mentioned, in 2011, we asked major content providers and others to join them in turning up IPv6 for a 24-hour period. This year, the ask was to turn up IPv6 and leave it on. We had well over 2,000 websites do that for this year. for World IPv6 launch. And this is IPv6 being enabled on the main website. So it's not ipv6.google.com. It is, you know, www.google.com. This means that if you have, you know, if you're being given IPv6 by your ISP, you have IPv6 enabled CPE at the edge of your home network, then you will use IPv6 to connect to this content without having to do anything as an end user. We had, as Frederick mentioned, some of the biggest websites and content providers in the world participating: Google, Facebook, YouTube, Yahoo, Wikipedia, Microsoft, Bing, Netflix, and many more. So the situation is that now, depending on, you know, where you are in the network, but well over 10% of the 11. I think a significant achievement in terms of moving, making progress with IPv6 deployment in the content on the content side. And so the next slide gives you a bit more detail on that. So there's a heat map there that shows you where, you know, what's the geographical spread of websites that we had participating in World IPv6 launch. And as you can see, it really was a global effort. We tried quite hard to find someone with a website in Greenland that they were willing to make available over IPv6. As you can see, we didn't succeed in that effort. But otherwise, this really was a global effort. And I think the message about IPv6 deployment and the tools and the knowledge and the services necessary for folks to do that is also now becoming becoming global, so that's really great to see. The graph at the bottom there is from a statistics tool that Lars Eggert runs at the URL on the slide, and what I wanted to point out there is that you can see quite clearly the red line is his metric for global website IPv6 support, which is a measure of the top 500 Alexa sites, and there you can see a spike in June last year, where we had when we held World IPv6 Day, and then you can also see the much larger impact of World V6 launch right at the far right hand side of that graph. And you know, what's interesting is that that impact isn't transient, right? That's a step change in the amount of IPv6 content on the network that is now a permanent feature. So really quite a significant event, I think. And on the next slide, just sort of rolling all of that up, well, what does this actually mean for the amount of IPv6 traffic on the network? This is much more difficult to get a handle on, because it really depends on, well, where are you measuring the traffic? What I'm showing on this slide are measurements from a couple of large aggregation points. So the Amsterdam Internet Exchange at the top of the slide and the DKIX exchange at the bottom of the slide. And here again, I mean, you can see that there's an order of, you know, but basically approximately doubling of the amount of IPv6 traffic at these aggregation points. The graph from DKIX at the bottom shows you is for an entire 12-month period. And there you can see something appears to have happened recently. So that's good news, I think, for IPv6 deployment as well. But you know, this is much more a function of where you're measuring what you'll see in terms of the shift in IPv6 deployment. But I think regardless of where you're looking, you're going to see increasingly large amounts of IPv6 traffic on the network now. I think this is my final slide. The next slide is really a pointer to work that the Internet Society is doing, which is our Deploy 360 program. And, you know, sort of following on from what Chris was saying about the need for, capacity building and outreach, the need to make the knowledge and the tools and the support required for folks looking to enable content for IPv6, deploy content on access networks, needs to become, you know, pervasive and globally available. And so what we're doing with the Deploy 360 program is to try and share information both about IPv6 deployment and DNS security, DNSSEC, including tutorials, case studies, training resources, and so on. And there's content there that's tailored for network operators or developers or content providers and so on. And so, you know, if you're in any of those categories and curious about IPv6 deployment, I'd encourage you to go and take a look at the resources that we're building there. And likewise, we're also looking to share resources that people have developed through this mechanism. So if you're sort of on the other side of the coin producing IPv6 training or other tutorials and so on, then again, if you want us to help you promulgate those around our network, then again, please get in touch and we can incorporate that with our program there. So that's all I had. I'd be happy to take any questions from the floor or the panelists if there are any.
Thanks, Matt. I think we have one question on remotely.
Thank you, Chris. We have a question from Mark Lampo, and it's for the ISOC speaker. The question says, there's a statement on slide 5 that, quote, the slide says, much of the work needs to be done for all sorts of consumer devices, end quote. But how much of this work is mandatory to provide at least basic security for internal networks? For example, there are IPv6-capable routers around without firewall capabilities. Is this acceptable given that one is pushed to public routable addresses for internal networks? And then there was a clarification that followed that says, with consumer devices, I do actually mean the home routers, not TVs or fridges.
Thanks for the question, Mark. There's been a long-running debate about what security functionality there should be in IPv6 CPE and routers. My personal view is that if you want to filter traffic, you should really do that on the end host. But I think, increasingly we're seeing CPE support recent standards that have come out of the IETF, which specify basic security functionality for IPv6 CPE. So I think as the products available in the marketplace catch up with the latest standards coming out of the IETF, we will see rudimentary firewalling capabilities, on by default in IPv6 CPE. Personally, I find firewalling at the edge of the network tends to cause more headaches than any benefits that you get from it. But I agree when consumer devices are IPv6 capable and they don't have any facility to filter inbound traffic themselves, then it is necessary to sort of do that by proxy. And there, I think the standards are baked in the IETF. It's really just a case of the products available in the market catching up with that.
Thanks, Matt. Hisham?
Yeah. Hisham Ibrahim, Afrinex IPv6 Program Manager. Thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to relay back some feedback I got from some of the ISPs in Africa and the Middle East. Especially the smaller ISPs, were IPv6 capable. However, most of the traffic was within the country itself. They weren't doing much international traffic because they were either tunneled or, their international provider couldn't provide them with IPv6 native. native. And that caused them a little bit of frustration. Through your heat maps, you would see, for instance, at the ISP, in the ISP one, you'd find Africa and the Middle East completely white, while you'd find with the websites, you'd find a lot of, you know, red spots popping up, which kind of means there is IPv6 there. So is this something, I know it's not easy to do, but is this something you may consider, if you're continuing doing the measurements, consider looking into local traffic as well, peering and stuff? Thank you.
Yes, thanks for the question. That's a very good point. And the measurement methodologies for all of this are never perfect. As I mentioned, for the access networks, we did have this this notion of a measurable network, and unfortunately, that meant that we ended up excluding a number of smaller network operators from our listing. What I would say is that there's an initiative that we've had running for a while now at the Internet Society, which is I'm trying to remember the URL. I think if you go to internetsociety.org/IPv6ISP heatmap. Hopefully, if you search for that online, you'll find the website I'm talking about, where we're trying to encourage ISPs and their subscribers to notify us of IPv6 service availability. There's no requirement to be measurable in any sense. It's really just you attest that you provide IPv6 services, and you provide a link to where those services are described online, and we'll include you in our database. And so that's a sort of ongoing tool that we have running and have set up to capture the broad scope of IPv6 deployment around the world.
Thanks, Matt. I think we have one more question from remote participation, but if we can answer it quite quickly, that would be good. I think we're running up against time.
So, Chris, actually, we have two. So, sorry, one came in. Do you want me to only read one and save the other for after?
Maybe if you could read both. I think, Matt, if you could just be mindful in answering, that we're running out of time.
Okay, thank you. So the first one is from Faisal Hassan from ISOC Bangladesh. It says, last year we had IPv6 Day. This year is IPv6 launch. What's the next step? And the next question is Mitsitli IT. I'm sorry if I said that wrong. The question is, what about legacy operating systems like IBM OS 2? Will they still be supported with IPv6?
So on the first question, I have a very simple answer, which is I don't know what the next step is. If you have suggestions, please get in touch. I also have no clue about IBM OS 2, but IPv6 is pretty well supported on the mass market operating systems that are widely deployed today, so Microsoft Windows, Mac OS, Linux, and so on.
Okay, thanks, Matt. I'll move, as I say, quickly along here. So the next presenters are Anders Rafting and Maria Hill to speak about the Swedish government experience.
Thank you very much, Chris. And yeah, there you go. Very good. Okay, my name is Maria Hall, and I'm working for the Minister of Enterprise, Energy and Communication at the Division of IT Policy. And I saw that Chris had a slide which said multi-stakeholderism in action. And actually, I would like to say that me and the Swedish government, we have been working with RIPE NCC since 2004. And by then, the expression multi-stakeholderism wasn't even invented. So we were doing that by anyway. So I think it's been very, very valuable for me and also for the Swedish government and for the recognition of how important it is to actually see all the technical issues actually can make a huge impact on policy activities and vice versa. So that's why I think it's important to mention that the multi-stakeholderism also have to take place, not only in this kind of environment, where we go and interact with each other in these kind of meetings. It also has to take place in the day-to-day business. Anyway, we can take the next slide. Okay, thank you very much. I was supposed to do that. Okay, thank you. Anyway, in August last autumn, actually 2011, the Swedish government launched something that we call the Swedish Digital Agenda, and that is a very, very broad strategical document that covers a bunch of different policy areas, IT policy areas, all from IT policy in healthcare, IT in school, IT policy in the digital inclusion issues, pretty much everything. Also like internet governance issues, of course, that I'm mostly working with, but also like freedom on the internet and development, freedom of expression and all these kind of things. But of course, one of the fundamental, chapters of one of the fundamentals pieces of this digital agenda covers IT infrastructure. And that is all from broadband issues, how to promote more broadband. It's a frequency policy and standardization and these kind of things. And one of the things that I have been saying to my minister and to the politicians in for the Swedish government and to my colleagues is, it's going to be a day very soon when we're going to have the first citizen in Sweden that is only going to have IPv6. So, of course, it's very important that we make our e-services, our public e-services, available for all citizens. And the Swedish public e-policy deployment is a very, very strong and very important area for us. And I have many, many colleagues that have been working with many different guidelines, many different strategical plans and so on for the Swedish public e-policy deployment. And we have many, many authorities in Sweden that are very successful in this. But of course, one of the fundamental things is actually technical reachability, which of course, one of the very important things is the IPv6 deployment. We can take the next slide. So this goes back rather long time in the Swedish IT policy area. And so a couple of years ago, we in our public e-services strategy, it said that we need to promote IPv6 by buying or in the public procurement have demands that we have to, that the software we buy, the hardware we buy has to be prepared for IPv6. So in 2010, we gave our regulatory authority, the PTS, Anders is sitting here next to me, an assignment to try to write some guidelines how to do this. If you're a public authority in Sweden, you should have like some kind of guideline or some kind of document that you could read how to do from ABC and follow a kind of a bullet point list how to do this. And of course, in combination with having those demands in the public procurement documents, having a guideline you can follow how to do it, that's two very important things. But what we also saw is that is not enough. We need to do even more actually to really, really promote the spread of IPv6, the use of IPv6 among our authorities. So we can go to the next slide. So what I said in this digital agenda that we launched in the autumn, we said that 2013, our Swedish public authorities has to be reachable by IPv6. So now in June 2012, actually just before me and Anders came here, we gave our Postal Telecommunication Agency, PTS, another assignment. And that's going to last during this year, 2012, but also next year, to make sure that what we said in the Swedish digital agenda is going to be made through, actually. That our Swedish public authority is going to be reachable. The e-services need to be reachable by IPv6. So this is something I want Anders to talk about a little bit more. But this assignment has a couple of steps, actually. One is that actually try to have these guidelines that were written 2010 to make sure the public authorities really use them, but also like a follow-up thing or a follow-up activity to see that it actually it works. So we from day to day or week by week can see that this is really happening, and that is something that Anders is going to talk about a little bit more. And in Sweden we have the government can't demand the municipalities, but I know that all the 290 municipalities that we have in Sweden are very interested in what's happening on the state level. So I'm sure that this assignment and these activities that PTS is going to do is also going to cover the municipalities. So that is actually something that we also in this follow-up activities in this assignment can see and follow how it's going on that municipality level as well. So by saying this, I give the floor to my colleague Anders Rafting from our Post and Telecommunication Agency. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria. And good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk about our measures and encourage the deployment of IPv6 in Sweden, and especially directed to the public sector. PTS, the Post och Telestyrelsen in Swedish, that's why PTS is a telecom regulator in Sweden. And we have five departments and 260 people working with making everyone to have access to efficient, affordable, and secure communication services. Myself, I work at the Network Security and Information Security Department within a unit called Robust Communications, where we, together with operators, try to make the infrastructure for electronic communications more robust and build more robustness than the market will do. So what we have done back in the years is back in 2009, we made our website accessible via IPv6. It was not very hard to do that. It was a way to show, to be in the forefront, to set a good example for the other authorities in Sweden. And now others have followed our example. So, yeah. We also been publishing special services at the link shown on the picture that is reachable via IPv6. And, of course, the domain name servers are reachable via IPv6. And also the email server since a year back. We also made dual home, and that's a thing that's not IPv6 related, but it's an important thing to do as we become more and more dependent on the electronic communication connections. So that's a thing to think of as a important provider of information and services in the public sector and also the private sector, I should say. And both the lines, dual home, means that you have one connection you have two connections to two different operators to be able to stand severe strains on the IP level, for example. So both those connections are both IPv4 and IPv6 connected. We also use something called direct access, which you all know what it is, and it used preferably IPv6. It works very well, I should say. So that's a VPN connection by IPv6. We also try to convince the public sector to take the decision to start deploy IPv6, because they are, as Maria said, there's a very important consumer and buyer of equipment. So if they can require IPv6 support in all the equipment they buy. It's a very good help to make the IPv6 ball start rolling. So we arranged seminars. We invited the public sector from different authorities, county administrative boards, municipalities, and also vendors and ISPs and operators of different kinds were there. And we succeeded in convincing around 300 participants each time, each of these times. 2010 and 2011 it was, yes. And the speakers from the government, from the RIPE, SSE, ISPs, and vendors. So we had all stakeholders on place and a very good discussions there. So that's a way to try to convince the public sector. We also, as Maria mentioned, got an assignment more than a year ago to provide a practical guidance. This guidance is the content, the real content of it. It's written by a guy that has own practical experience on how to install and run and test and evaluate IPv6 in all kinds of equipment. So what's is written in this report is one way to do it. There might be other ways, of course. So I guess it's a kind of religion to install IPv6, perhaps, but this is one way that works. So, yeah, the main text provides some general methodology to do this. And there are appendixes, annexes, with detailed configuration advice. So the leading ideas in the guidance is to try to make the board for the authority to take the decision and do it on in time, so not to become in busy, to become in a hurry and be short of time. That also tend to be expensive when the all shall have access to expertise at the same time. So the device is to deploy in four phases, to take stock to see what you have, what you need, and plan the address plan, and activate, evaluate, and test, and then manage. Of course, you shall keep your IPv4 connection unbroken and deploy IPv6 in parallel. That's an ideal way to connect to the internet. Start on a small scale with a website. It's not so difficult. And when procuring new equipment, preferably, it's a good advice to use RIPE 501 recommendations for IPv6 and all other ICTs that we say in the that report also. And if you you can find this guidance on this link, and we would very much appreciate your comments and improvements, feedback, either to me or to Erika Hersius, who was the project leader for this. So we will continue our IPv6 work, and now we have got, as Mary mentioned, a new assignment to carry out the promotion and follow up the deployment of IPv6 at authorities. And we are also already almost ready to deploy IPv6 on our local, both wired and wireless network on the authority, on the private network and authority. So very soon we can reach the whole internet. And I think that's a thing to be an incentive for other authorities, if you ask them, do you want to reach the whole internet or only a part of it? Of course, you would like to reach the whole internet via IPv6. And then today, we will publish a list on public authorities which support IPv6 for the web, for the DNS, for the email on our website. So that would be a spur to hurry up. And this is how it could look like. It was before I really knew how it looked, but It will be around this. We will see who has IPv6 domain name, who has MX records in the email service for IPv6, and who has DNS service reachable via IPv6. And last, I have this picture, food for thought. We must be mindful that still there is 2/3 of the world's population that does not use internet daily. So I don't think anyone knows exactly how these are going to be connected, but there are some will be connected via proxies, some via NATs, some via carrier-grade NATs, some via perhaps native IPv6. So, and gradually they will turn to IPv6, to native IPv6. And the black areas here, the dark blue areas, who already have abundance of IPv6 addresses, IPv4 addresses, I mean, and since long have been using internet, should be loyal and to learn to speak both languages, so to say, to provide content to all the world. So, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anders and Maria. We're a bit under the gun in terms of time, but Louis, if you've got a short question.
Yes, thank you. Louis Lee, ASO Address Council Chair. Just real quick, this gave me an excellent idea for offering a suggestion for the next IPv6 type event, is to focus on specific sectors, and starting with the public sector. Maybe you can take this success story as a roadshow to other areas, other countries, for them to focus inward, invite the government authorities, the municipalities, counties, and also the ISPs that are learning to do V6 and the ISPs, local ISPs that already have V6. They can exchange information, work with the government at the same time, and perhaps promote some inward local rather than the whole, like a world focus. So get that started so that at some date they can all feel like they can all do this at the same time and feedback to everyone else.
Thanks, Louis. I think we have one question on remote as well.
Thank you, Chris. This question is also from Faisal Hassan from ISOC Bangladesh. You mentioned about the IPv6 guidance manual. I think that's a very good initiative to motivate and guide governments. Is it available publicly?
Yes, it's available publicly. Okay, it was on the slide. So, pardon? It can be found on the following address, www.pts.se/deploy-IPv6. So I repeat, www.pts.se/deploy-IPv6.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll move straight along with Andre.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Andre Philippe, and you know, my task is a little bit to have some presentation about the position of CCTLE in this kind of game. You know, CCTLEs are not public sector; they don't have any hard possibilities how they can really direct the community. But they are central institutions, so they have a very special role in this environment. Next slide, please. So while waiting for the next slide, I think I will start a little bit talking about...
the slide advancer is up on the table.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't know that. It's much better now. So the registry itself, of course, there are... I don't think I will elaborate about it too much, but there are certain ways that the registry has to do to be really IPv6 ready. And since I said it's sort of unique institution, has a special role inside every country, this registry should really be one of the first who implements IPv6. It's not just about, you know, bring connectivity to the DNS servers, which are the software that usually run DNS services, usually ready. But there is more stuff inside the registry system. The registry has to ensure that IPv6 GLU records can be included into database. And IP address is on many places in the registry system. So it's about just database, who is the zone generator, and an EPP, which is the protocol that the registry speaks with registrars. So there's a lot of places where IP address is used, and the registry has to ensure that everything is perfect. So that's a lot of work that has to be done, but it has to be done first in the country to help the country to adopt IPv6. And if you can look at those numbers, the situation doesn't look so bad. 9 of 13 root servers, and of course that are not just servers but clouds, are ready for IPv6, so that's more than enough to really deploy IPv6 widely. That ensure a stable function of IPv6 at DNS protocol. And also vast majority of top-level domains is ready for IPv6, or at least has one of the name servers on IPv6. I tried a simple test 2 days ago, and that time it was 267 out of 311 TLDs that do support IPv6, at least at the name servers. Specifically in the ccTLD world, it's 211 out of 249, so roughly the same number, 85%. So that's about the root level and top level. Now a little bit how about the domain itself, how the TLD can measure progress of the users of the domain. So if we are speaking about ccTLD, we can a little bit say country. What the top-level domain administrator can do, he can measure quad A records inside the zone, so he can check all the www.somedomain.tld if there is a quad A record. Of course, also if MX points to some finally to some quad A record, and the same applies for the name servers. So there is a lot of metrics that can be taken to really measure the progress. An example from this local country, if you go to the URL labs.nic.cz/IPv6, you will see a lot of graphs how we measure progress in our country or in our domain. And there is also a very nice site from Hurricane Electric that tries to summarize many top-level domains, or at least those that provide zone file, which are not all of them, but some of them are included in this report. So it's very nice if you want to get a very quick overview. Another thing which can be really measured is the percentage of DNS queries. That's also something says about the readiness of the country to IPv6. Usually, the DNS protocol, the percentage of IPv6 in DNS protocol is a little bit higher than in the other protocols, because DNS is by this design proxy service, so the clients are asking some DNS servers at internet service provider's site, and the core of the networks are usually IPv6 ready, so that's why the percentage of queries or packets of DNS is usually higher than in case of the other protocol. And there is also one little thing. The fact that there is a DNS record or quad A DNS record doesn't mean that there is also the service running. That was especially the case before those IPv6 days both, because that was exactly the some people just think that starting IPv6 is just to include a record into DNS, but there is a little bit more that has to be done. So sometimes there are problems with several sites that forget this. This is a local situation in the Czech Republic. I think it's pretty good so far. We have roughly about 30% of web servers that uses domain.cz IPv6 ready. That's the measurement we do every month. So you can see there is a high progress caused by the world's IPv6 launch. This is the same situation, but we are talking about the mail servers, a little bit lower number, which surprises me. It should be easier, but still there is a visible progress. But you know, it's not bad. And this is the percentage of domains that has at least one DNS server IPv6 enabled. So it's roughly 50%, and that means that many of the domains are hosted by professional companies, by registrars or DNS hosting providers. And again, those companies, the core networks are usually ready for IPv6 much more than the edges. And there is something I discussed a little bit earlier. These graphs show the percentage of IPv6 DNS queries in Czech Republic versus IPv4. So it's much better than it has been before. You know, there is some green line visible, and it's in the peaks about 10% of queries. So that sounds very good. That's not bad. That means that many ISPs in the country, at least at their core networks, seriously implemented IPv6 and also connected DNS resolvers to that. Another methodology which is very interesting, you know, measuring number of IPv6 enabled web servers in domain is interesting, but you might, for example, face the problem that all those that are IPv6 enabled are not important. So it's much important to measure really used websites. So IPv6 Observatory has their own methodology, and they usually test IPv6 reachability of Alexa top 500 websites in the country. So that gives you a much better picture how the country is ready for IPv6. They update the ranking every 3 months, and they do measurement every day. So that's very, very nice overview of how countries progress. They are focused on European Union, but their statistics also include USA, Canada, China, and India, and maybe some others. I'm not sure. If you want to see it online, there is URL ipv6observatory.eu. And from those data, they can make that very nice maps. You can see Czech Republic very well. It's one of the darkest there, so you can see the borders, and that's the country you are here now. So not surprisingly, Czech Republic is one of the first. I think today it's a little bit more. It's 14.4%, so that's quite nice progress. And that was mainly a result of all those IPv6 events that happened in this country. So a little bit about that. As I said, the role of TLD is a little bit special. We cannot do much like forcing people to adopt IPv6, but we can do a lot with communication. So we do a lot on that side. We, for example, as we have the CZNIC Academy, we did a lot of training for professionals. We really try to spread information about IPv6 in the media. We also printed a book about IPv6. And we are very lucky that we chose June the 8th at 2010 as the first seminar about IPv6, or first big conference. We started communication about IPv6, and we had a huge panel of ISPs and local service providers about IPv6. And, you know, exactly 1 year later, World IPv6 Day was announced. So we again used that opportunity to have another conference just focused on IPv6. And again, we have tried to bring government people, ISPs, and also content providers together to discuss what are difficulties of IPv6. And the same happened on June 2012, and has amazing results because some of the ISPs really started to support IPv6. And on the last conference, the largest, the incumbent provider, has announced that it's going to start provide services on IPv6 to the end users, so using DSL and things like that. And last but not least, we have also IPv6 Text Laboratory. So it's a laboratory where everyone can come and test if the device is really ready for IPv6. There is IPv6 only network without IPv4. We have these lamps and everything. So really all the CPE devices can be tested. We also provide some of the tools. One of them, which is the HTML widget. You can see it on our homepage, www.nic.cz.
And it's a widget that informs you whether you ISP support DNSSEC validation and also IPv6 protocol, and you can also measure IPv6 if you wish. And it's open source, so if you want to use it, you can download it and translate to your language and so on. And last thing I would like to a little bit refer on is the router catalog. It was mentioned, I think, in ISOC presentation that there is a trouble with CPE devices, that not all these home routers, cable modems, ADSL, whatever you want to call it, do support IPv6. So we wanted to create a website that should help the end users that are buying a newer hardware to buy a proper one, IPv6 ready one, so they would be sure that they wouldn't change it later. So all the IPv6 features are tested in all laboratories, so we really guarantee the results and publish protocol how we tested it. And some eShops, you know, helped us with that, so they are providing us new devices and we are testing them. And we created a website, there's a URL on the screen if you are interested in, where really you can look at, you can try to find the router. There's not much of them because really just a few of them really support IPv6, but we believe this database is going to grow and we could be able to provide much more information. But you know, good for the Czech people here is that the CPEs in the database are really local available, so everyone can really buy it and use it. So this is just example. You can have a filter search, so you can search whatever feature is important for you. And, of course, you can also make comparison of two different models. So that's the router catalog, and that's, you know, a brief overview about activities that we as a CSER TLD can do locally in this country to help this IPv6 effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrei. I'd like to, yeah, any questions, maybe we'll save them till the end. We might power straight on through to Jeff Houston's presentation.
Is this on? Do I have to press something? Good morning. My name is Jeff Houston. I'm with APNIC. I have exactly 10 minutes and 42 slides. So that's 14.4 seconds per slide. So I better move on. This is a glimpse into the future. It's a very personal glimpse, but it actually ties in a lot with IPv6. But before you try and look at the future, maybe it's actually useful to look backwards. I have a secret to share with you. I'm older than I look because I remember these dinosaurs. I remember these bastards. They were huge. This was a ripper. This was the latest one from Digital. These were so special. They had their own room. They had their own air. And this one was even planned to have its own water. The water-cooled monster, but they couldn't make the water work. This was the last of an era. This was the end of the dinosaur mainframe. The point I want to make is that if you think 20 years ago was only yesterday, almost nothing from that era survives in today's internet environment. Not the operating systems apart from Unix, not even the protocols apart from IP, and certainly not the hardware. Very, very little of 20 years ago is today. What about 10 years ago? What about if we'd looked just 10 years ago? The world was full of PCs, and they were ugly bastards, weren't they? I'm like, the word design just didn't exist in that environment. This was the snappiest thing from HP, and God, it's ugly. Separate screen, massive bastard. It's a video screen. We hadn't done flat screens then. The box was a huge, noisy box. It had 5-inch floppies. Anyone still have one of these? Get rid of it. It'll only cost you $50 to buy a new one. So even 10 years ago, it's a different world. What about today? This is from March of this year. Tim Cook said something really quite special that I think is actually reverberating. It's not the world of the PC anymore. Like the dinosaur, like the mainframe, sorry, they're both dinosaurs. The world we're living in is truly a post-PC world. So let's just see where you are on the dinosaur scale. Is this you? Do you have one of these at work or at home? Your own special place you go to? Up here in the hotel on the floor above you is the internet access room. So the internet is something you go to. It has its own power, its own lighting, its own wired bandwidth, these big comfy chairs and big comfy screens. It has privacy. The internet is a destination. All of you have one of those? You better not, because that's old stuff. Because the world is changing phenomenally, massively. And almost everything we understood about this environment is changing. Because the internet's now what you do when you do other things. It's anywhere and everywhere. It's no longer reliable power, it's battery power. It's no longer a full-sized keyboard. We've got it down to one thumb and one button and gestures. Connectivity is by radio. It's trivial. It's commonplace. It's abundant. And it's not a destination. It's something else. It's what you drag out of your pocket when you're lost in Prague and you're trying to figure out whether to turn left or right. Truly, it's changed that much. We don't ask for paper maps anymore. The map is in your pocket. Email is constantly with you if that's what you want. If I'm having an argument over coffee, over what a word means, I don't go home to a dictionary. I bring out my little device and look it up then and there. The internet is now trivial. The internet is now everywhere. And by God, we've been working. We have been working bloody hard. There really are 2.5 billion internet users. How many were there 20 years ago? Nowhere near it. This has been a phenomenal story of amazing mobilization worldwide. Of course, there's a bigger target out there because we've managed to flog off 5 billion mobile phones. So we're getting there. Inexorably, we are getting there. Because now 750 folk are mobile internet users and the numbers just keep on going up. And what about tomorrow's predictions in this market? You might think the domain name business is fun and wonderful and full of boundless opportunities with numerous GTLDs in the future. But the prodigious future of mobility is far greater than that. Our expectations of massive growth continue from almost every magazine, every source of information, everything you find on the internet predicts a prodigious future. Is it true? I like this picture. This is in Nullarbor in the middle of Australia. Australia is a very big continent, but most of it looks exactly like that. So you don't need to go there. You've seen that. So, you know, tick it off. So anyway, 2017, just 5 years out. So it's pretty close, yeah? Pretty close. What's it going to look like? I think the wired world, from an industry perspective, is now a ghetto, a slum. The whole reason why public programs are taking the onus of trying to do fibre wiring is the private industry has no incentive to invest. For them, the wired world is a ghetto. Everything is mobile. How many mobile units did we ship last year? 270 million units. God, the mainframe industry would have had a heart attack trying to make that many units. How expensive is a mobile phone to manufacture? Less than $100. What about the software? Oh, that's easy. Android's free. What about content? Oh, damn it, let's just use the web. All of a sudden, all of this stuff just comes together. Nobody makes large, high-power chips anymore. We're all about quad-core chips that run on 3 volts and have 7 hours of battery life. Because that's volume. Volume is there in your pocket now. The world is a mobile world. Look at Apple's numbers. That $600 billion company, the largest by stock valuation company on the planet. Quarter 3, 2010, 8.4 million iPhones. The next quarter, it tripled. And even iPads, everyone loves them. Again, tripled. Profit, 7.3 billion. And in the final quarter of 2011, whoa, 37 million iPhones, 15 million iPads, $13 billion of profit. If that isn't a clear signal that it's not about domain names, it's not even about, you know, wired stuff. This is about mobility. This is where the internet is. So let's look at the address plant, because everyone needs an address. Packets don't work without them. We can plot demand. That's the red line. And in V4, we can plot supply. That's the blue line. Asia Pacific ran out last year. Europe and the Middle East, you've got 4 weeks. That's if you all behave nicely. And then no more. Even the North American continent, served by Aaron, early February at the moment, according to predictions. So within 4 years, the shortfall, the excess demand we can't service with new addresses, is going to get close to 1 billion units, close to 25% of the old IPv4 unit. If you think address markets will see you through, the future you're looking at is a remarkably small one. It's going to buy you time, not a future. Because address exhaustion, no matter how you look at it, is inevitable. It's not a fate you can negotiate with. And look at that blue line from APNIC. When this industry panics, we're professionals. We panic bloody well. So by 2017, there's no V4 left anywhere. In the next 5 years, we have to cope with this. And what we're going to do is start trading. The aftermarket is inevitable. But we're playing with stuff we've never played with before. The last time we tried auctioning off spectrum in Europe for 3G, we sent companies bankrupt because in the euphoria of outbidding their competition, their imaginations far exceeded reality. If the price goes too high, we stuff up the network badly. It fragments and dies. If the price is highly volatile, who the hell wants to invest in something that's highly volatile? Bank bonds, anyone? Private investment likes surety, not volatility. Volatility increases the risk and pushes away investment. If we want this internet to cover those other 4 billion folk, we need stable investment platforms, stable technologies, and stable environments. And we're not it. We are pushing this away. This is bad. This is really bad. And you might have thought from the last few speakers that there is a choice. Sorry, there isn't a choice. We've made it. V6 is the future. But in reality, it's not. There is a choice out there. About 1% of the world's users actually use V6 every day, and the other 99% cannot. It's on their machines. Microsoft has done a great job, but the last mile access providers are not delivering. They're still doing V4, and they are not committed. They see that there's still a choice because they think that it's viable, an option, not to do 6, to squash everything into HTTP, and recycle private address space in V4. Didn't we just see 100.64 going back to the carriers to eke out another few more days of desperate existence? CGNs is what they see as a future, and they are not committed to 6. This is an industry that is deeply divided over where we are going. And nobody is in control. Because what's going to determine this is actually those pressures in the private investment market. What determines this is actually market forces rather than regulatory impost. We liberalised, we deregulated, we passed this over to markets. So that's 5 years. Fun, eh? Let's go further out. Let's push it out to 10 just to see what's going to happen. Quite frankly, if anyone thinks that V6 days and transitions and the transition industry has a long-term future and that's where they're going to base their career, I have some awfully horrible news for you. Either this transition happens within 10 years or the next slide's going to happen. We will not run V4 forever. Look at what happened to DECnet. Look at what happened to SNA. Look at what happened to dear old AppleTalk. Wasn't that a brilliant protocol? And, of course, X25. When it dies overnight. There is no long-term future if we're going to V6. We can't afford that kind of dual-track system. CGNs have no future. They scale for about a year, and then all of a sudden the bill gets intense. After that, you're driving into application-level gateways and heavily fragmented networks. So if we have a network in 2022, it's V6. If we're doing what we're doing now and prevaricating, say goodbye to one internet. It won't be there. Because we can't glue a network of 4 billion folk together in 10 years' time, no matter how you try and do this. We don't realise how brittle commonality is. The internet is a very unique phenomenon. In electricity, I think I'm in a world of 220 volts. Over the other side of the Atlantic, it's 110 volts. You use funny little pins that are round. In Australia, we use flat pins that are angled. My God, this is easy stuff. How did we get it wrong? Even radio spectrum, we all use different ones. There's almost nothing that we've done in this world that's all been the same. Even the DNS, we've gone down the IDN route. We love local variation. We love to adorn, fragment, and break. And we're going to do that with the internet if we don't do six. So if we manage a six network, let's be nice about this and let's be optimistic. After all, I only got minus 2 minutes. It will be radio. Spectrum will be everything. The spectrum will be a heavily contested resource. And if you think it's under a lot of competition now with 4G, you've got another thought coming. There will be a whole lot more femtel cell cellular services. We're going to squash down the distance and increase the intensity of use. I suspect that fibre is just a backhaul to last mile radio because it's so convenient having everything in my pocket, having everything on my luggage tag, having everything in RFID, and we will go there because silicon is a volume industry and it loves to chatter. Current stuff about cloud, it'll be over in 10 years. Quite frankly, we've seen this industry centralised, decentralised. At the moment, we're all in data centres. It's highly fashionable. At some point, we're going to distribute it back out again. Look at Skype. It doesn't actually run a data centre. It just makes everyone else run it for them. All of a sudden, we're going to go back to that model once we use up cloud and so on. So it's all fashion. Almost at the end of the continent, seas at the other end, 20 years out. Wow, I can't do it. I'd be lying. I have no idea of 20 years, and neither do you if you're honest. This is a remarkable thing. Have a look at it afterwards in detail. It came out a couple of months ago, and it looks at the spread of technical things over the last century and the pace of adoption. So it talks about the telephone, the refrigerator, and the stove. My parents had a wood-burning stove. This whole electricity stuff is recent. And you look about even clothes washers, and it goes on to air conditioning and the cell phone. The slopes get more vertical. We adopt technology worldwide at fantastic pace, and we recycle faster and faster and faster. Thankfully, I won't have this crappy old laptop anymore. I'll have a bright, shiny new thing. And it won't even be a laptop. And I'm not even sure that it will fit in my pocket. I think it might even fit in something smaller than that. Or maybe it'll be a bunch of devices that interact with the environment and where I am. But I know one thing for sure. It'll be different. And I also know another thing which is really quite remarkable. 20 years ago, the phone service determined what the service was. And it was the phone company that determined what was going to happen. They were in control of the future of this industry. That doesn't exist anymore. Because when we liberalised, when we deregulated, when we blurred the line between applications, computation and communication, we actually empowered the user. It's a post-PC world where computation, storage and communications are just abundant commodities. It's not a high-value job. It's just a commodity utility. It's like water. What's going on now is it's these mass-produced consumer devices that completely shape the world. And the innovation is one of refinement. And if we want that future, if we want a future where the internet just disappears into the fabric, the one precondition we need, the absolute one precondition, is a single, embracing, and lightly refined, consistent single technology. I can't deliver that to you in V4. Cannot. You won't get there. unless this industry figures out that its long-term future and the long-term interests of you and I as consumers are recognised, unless they move to V6 within the next 3 years and make that 1% 100% and stop looking at transition as a long-term career path, but as something we just have to get done and get over with. Unless we do that, we might as well all give up, because when the internet fragments, those domain names are useless too. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jeff. As Jeff noted, I think we've slid in just over the wire here, so apologies to anyone who has any questions. I think we might have to wrap it up. First, thank you to all of the panellists here who've taken part today and provided some really useful, valuable insights. As moderator, I'm going to use my privilege here just to make one final note announcement. There is actually a global IPv6 deployment survey in the field right now. So basically, that's something that anyone can fill in. Certainly, everyone in this room, I think, would be a good person to fill that in. I don't have the URL, so I'll give you, I think the easiest thing to do is to say nro.net. That's the number resource organization website. Under the news and announcements section on the homepage, there's a link to that 2012 global IPv6 deployment survey. So please go there and fill it out if you have any time. Okay, thank you, as I said, to all of our panelists, to everyone here today, and to all of people who asked questions. Thank you. Thank you.